Good evening and welcome. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I am the library's librarian for American and English literature. I should say that these events are sponsored by the library's Computing and Technology. We have several event series, the full calendar of which for both series, the Friday Night Film Series and the Michigan Writers Series, are over here for you to take on your way out, if you wish. Tonight's reading is from Gordon Henry. Gordon Henry's novel, The Light People, was nominated for a National Book Award in 1994 and won the American Book Award in 1995. His poetry and fiction have been published in The Black Warrior Review, Mid-American Review, Stories Migrating Home, and North Dakota Quarterly, as well as in numerous other journals and anthologies. He is an enrolled member of the White Earth Chippewa Tribe in Minnesota. While his father served in the United States Navy, Henry grew up traveling and living on military bases and on the White Earth Reservation. He has been actively involved in the traditional Native American ceremonies for most of his adult life. After studying at Michigan State University and earning his PhD in literature at the University of North Dakota, Henry has taught at Ferris State University, Alma College, University of Michigan, and was a Fulbright lecturer in Spain. He currently teaches in the English department at Michigan State University. Please welcome Gordon Henry.
We would. Thank you, Michael. And miigwech also to Peter Berg and Deanna Rivera and library staff for this opportunity to read tonight. And for those people who continue to support the Michigan Writers Series. And I also just want to do what's standard for me is just to give thanks for this day. I managed to live this at least this far through another day. And for all of you being here tonight. I'd also like to dedicate this reading to a colleague, Arthur Athanason. And later on toward the end, I'll read a poem for Arthur. A few years back, I was invited to submit work for an anthology, American Indian Autobiography. And I'd never really written about myself, at least directly, that I knew of. And so I was having some trouble coming up with something to write. And I called Gerald Visner, and I said, I don't think I can do this. And he said, well, don't think of it as writing. Think of it as performance. Which didn't help me in the least, but this is what I came up with. And this is called Entries into the Autobiographical Eye. And this is the first door. This is broken into four parts, four doors. But I won't read the whole thing. It would take us all night. And I am not postmodern or modern, a sign or signifier between signifieds, surreal or existential, neo-traditional or beat, transcendental or metaphysical, confessional shaman, warrior, or sun priest. Not trickster nationalist exile or anthropocentric psychodramatizer. I'm not dishwasher safe, microwavable, Sunday supplement collector plate sellout or shade. I'm not a shadow chaser or orphan boy, pop icon, trapper, trader, weaver, stone carver, powwow, investor, or an angel looking backward. I'm not an arboreal rodent, roadkill, or coyote totem taster, clan speaker, bandstander, or dream song, sonnet carrier. I'm not a villanelle revivalist, or wendigo washer, fumigator, suicide doctor, freeze-dried mystic, or lone ranger lover. I'm not a heaven seeker, or hell raiser, church leveler, drunken wanderer, sneaking, creeping, powwow playboy, or two-thirds higher honor song singer, our hotel lecturer, casino medicine keeper, our shell-shooting crow, our weasel, otter, or turtle. Better or worse, I'm not a water spirit, stargazing, anthropological shapeshifter, our checkout line half-breed hero, our formula detective, divided between ordinary and non-ordinary, our authentic, natural, unnatural, deconstructive, white-hating eros or ethos or pathos, Apollonian or Dionysian, radical or card-carrying blood quantum physicist. I'm not an apple, delicious, golden, or otherwise, or rotten. I'm not a tomahawk hair splitter polemicist, or a two-stepper 10 steps away from a 12-stepper. I'm not a thunder being, or light being, writer of wrongs, or prepackaged bead-working pipe carrier, or pipe fitter, iron worker, or artificer of law, politics, of extraterrestrial intelligence, Not a medicine wheel spokesman or blackjack dealer or chaos theorist, social contractor under federal control. I'm not a plain clothes wardrobe keeper, sign wearer or graffiti artist, or epidermal epistemologist with nobody home, with an idea, an ego. I'm not a paper skin or a well-read skin or a next to skin. I'm not an intellectual, personal mythologizer disguised as a historian or a Jessica Wanabu or what Wabano or a crystal gazer or a new age bookseller with a men's movement mind. I'm not a biological timekeeper or a one and only to be believed or not, to be forgotten. Not a presence or absence, intense. Not a psychic autobiographer, an archaeologist on the fringes, a firekeeper, doorman, or a burnout exclusionist, a disillusionist, or a sounder of the senses, or a central geographer. I'm not a contradictor, or a great waboose, like or as the king of ghosts, or a Star Lake ricer, an either or demanding neither. I'm not a word waster, a word recycler, an apocalyptic problematic poser, or a wholly imaginative word charger. Not Gnostic, not a list maker, a cataloger, a horoscopic celestial reflector, or a sacred mechanic in the absence of a culture. I'm not a technological nightmare flood recollector, or a little person on familiar terms with a cultural giant. I'm not a winter-tongued salamander licking the sky, or a relativist, or a roadman, morning star man, or a hang-around-the-fort fetish hanger with a broken Chevy. I'm not first-person omniscient narrator of second- or third-person confluences of consciousness, or hyper-essential parabolic metaphrastic knobby, or a Cherokee, or a Sioux, or Lakota, or Dakota, or a house blesser, prepackaged strawberry mist, or a car fragrance, or a savior, or a minority, or a cannon fodder, or a fry bread concessionaire, an ethnic festival, a wild ricer, or panik naboop. I'm not a fighting Illini, an eagle, a hawk, or a peacemaker. I'm not a professor of any kind of highly classified studies. I'm not a synecdoche, collective or unconscious, anima or inanimate, or an actor, plotter, didactic, or mimetic, or metahuman, or polytheist, or an agnostic, or a death song poet, or a prophet, or a pilgrim, or a ghost supper waiting to happen. Not a pure spirit, or a nascent name on a material precipice, or a materialist with a secondhand clothes. Nor am I a Euromuse, looking for a place to land. Or shall I claim more simply, I am not any of the above, on any line or any form to be signed below, or signified as other, with any other signified between terms and conditions, esoteric to names, spiritual or otherwise, exoteric to names, European or otherwise. Shall I claim more simply, I am none of these. Still, these are all my relations, and for them I am thankful. The last time we visited, I was working on a story, I think, when I say we visited, the last time I read at Michigan State, that I've been working on for many, many years. It's called Seminole Futures, and it's about a group of tribal people who decide to sell their semen. And so this is one of the characters in the Seminole Futures story. This is the guy who's sort of the coyote of this story. His name is Richard Little Wolf. And once the men decide to sell their semen, knowing that in the future the per capita Indian semen will be worth a lot of money, the women decide that they'll sell their eggs. And so the men hire this guy to steal the women's eggs. And this is his little story. Someday you'll remember me. I'm the one who stole the eggs from the Ogamaque cryogenetics market. First I lit cedar and wrapped a thin blanket of her blue smoke around myself, as if a woman I once loved were singing as she held me beneath that blanket under a moon of a second night's waning. After that, I worked prayer into tobacco, smoked a little, and made an offering on that gray stone memorial outside the tribal warehouse with a historical plaque screwed on, reading, "In memory of Meskwawashkesh, respected leader and troublemaker for Big Knives." Then I danced around the old warehouse a couple of times, came back in the direction I started, and I went to the warehouse door with the key Joseph Amick got from his wife's purse while she was sleeping off the glow of a Willie Nelson concert in the casino entertainment hall. I held the key up to the moonlight, then sang the song I used to sing before I got sober for the 12th time. If you don't want me, don't dance around me. Dance, go. On over there then and dance. Hey, I put the key in, turned it a hair two ways, felt the give in the left side of the lock, and I turned it hard left. A gaggle of geese lifted, hemming over blue sky somewhere. A lock clicked open. I turned the doorknob, drew the flashlight with the peyote stitch handle out from my right pocket, and I sprayed light left deep into the warehouse. I walked a ways between a few pallets of office paper, a few more of tribal museum brochures, saw the interior office right where a mix said it was. I went there, held the light up to the door glass, and read the sign, Ogimakwe Enterprises. I fished out keys, a second stolen key, this one by Darwin Keyser from the glove box of his wife Samantha's Lincoln Continental Plus. I put the key in more forcefully, turned left, shoved the door open. I held the flashlight into the office, went to the receptionist's desk, took keys from the center desk drawer, and went to another interior door and opened that. Inside, I found hanging on the wall to the right, from the same tack that ran through a punched hole in the top center of the tribal cops of the year calendar, I took that key and got the hell out of there with the glossed eidolon of topless Sergeant December lingering in my mind, with protect and to serve on each breast of his bench press built chest. There was a time when there wasn't too much fighting around here. The women were bingoing like Catholics. The men were golfing like, how else can I put it, like white men on the near side of a big pension staring them in the face, or on the far side of anything resembling a midlife crisis. Then I don't know what happened. A mix said a medicine person came through and got pissed at the MC at the fall powwow and cursed the whole place. Keyser said it was the BIA that caused it. Arthur Bourgeau said, no, he said, we forgot to make an offering to the spirits when those construction guys cut down that first big tree at the site where the new substance abusement center is going to be. I don't know. I don't go in for theories until they happen. And most theories don't happen until whoever thought of them observes something that makes them come up with a theory. That's why you really can't trust Bourgeau. He's schooled like that. He's got too goddamn many theories. He's got word theories, bird theories, work theories, theories about the sun talking. He's got theories about the pervasiveness of glass and oil-based materials and about the proliferation of images as the replacement for psychic phenomena. He's got theories about equivalencies, hotel cycles in the tourist season between the off-season and the on-season. He's got theories about Nana Bourgeau, Majikawis. He's got theories about tribal health nurses and cancer rates. He's got theories about earthquakes and orgasms and architecture. He's got theories about elevators and dream space orientation. He's got physics theories about which he claims there's no difference between come in and go in. He's got a theory for everything but the origin of theories, which he says can't have an origin because they never manifest, because what doesn't manifest is spirit not manifested, and theories are not of the spirit. I know this because I worked many a slow night of surveillance with him at the casino hotel. So who is to say what happened between the men and women in this once beautiful and holy land of most sacred ancestors? If you'll talk to the men, they'll say the women got jealous. If you talk to the women, they'll say the men started spreading their seed in unnatural ways among strangers for purely economic reasons. They might be right. They might be jealous. When there's no way of knowing, I go back, take the road home to Makuntz, and I talk to the old ones there, my two uncles, the twins Anung and Gijish Martin. Together, given the right moon, a deck of cards and a bottle of Fairbanks port, they can divine the truth, read the air for echoes of voices of the real stories, and the frequency of smoke they remember from every res stovepipe and chimney breath, from the number and seasonal distance of every passing vehicle on the road to tribal housing, tribal health, tribal ops, and the casino. Anung even claims they know the truth by vibration, by how quickly seeping water soaks into earth, by how long it takes wet matter to come to mud. I'm sure the truth is all that and more. But for now, everything I've known to be wrong, the twins have always been right, and they tell the story like this from the point of view of those whose voices can be picked up between, can be conveyed in hiss, can be picked up on a frequency of modulation which cannot be conveyed in hiss or crackle between sundown and sunrise, to be lost sometimes on roads through Stonehill passages or beneath old railroad tracks, bridges where angel-loved chief still reads large in orange and concrete, to be picked up sometimes in quiet of morning outside some city, caught in the interminable exhaust of autumn. That I've never quit writing poetry, though some people might claim that I should. I always manage to get poetry in there somewhere, and I've been working on a few things. I'm going to read one for Arthur later. But I get caught up in urban landscapes every so often, and I wrote this this poem. It's a letter for a Minnehaha woman. You know where I'm going. On the same street past the tracks where 7 Augusts ago we drained a few pre-dawn quarts, made promises against a mural of imperial oppression on the wall of the Workers of the World bookstore, later closed up and reopened later as a Hollywood video. Now, a few tripped out two-spirit skin women verbally dance dirty with a panhandling Devil's Lake wino in a Viking shirt outside the currency exchange. As I make my way toward you over the bridge nicknamed Suicide, with a graffiti light bulb launch point on the railing and sprayed fluorescent sketches of pornographic body parts, like the orange hard-on firing dollar signs at nipple targets as big as a one-man tent on the concrete supports underneath. Try not to blame me that the powwow heyoka got your cell number from the table at the city park where I carved the digits with a leatherman before I put the last number down in blood I drew with broken glass and mixed with a pinch of ash from my menthol camel. He wrote it all backwards under his Lakota name on his fist. Just tell him when he calls. You love it when he calls. He'll go back to dancing while reading the news in the circle, just like he did behind the middle-aged jingle-dressed matrons, dancing their moccasin-matching bags with limp wrist, glaring under beady flora of woodland tiaras, knowing and not liking the clown mocking their steps behind them at the Upper Midwest gathering. I heard from Spotted Eagle at the halfway house as he ticked off plans for my release from 3 freezing moons of treatment. No drugs, no pot, no speed, no more black Cadillacs, no more shooting your grandfather's IHS painkiller prescriptions, no drinking, no driving, no parties, no bad influences. AA twice a week, eh? You go to meetings at Our Lady of What You Call, or you can go on Tuesdays at the Indian Center. Just give in to a higher power and keep up the sober monologues. Your ma's still hanging on to that big knife bricklayer who ate the leftovers I brought from the Hard Times Cafe for you the day I walked all the way back here in clothes I found in a garbage bag in the back of a Dodge pickup parked in the drive at Uncle Salem's, only to find you'd gone north for a funeral. I'm trying again to find you. Could it be more complicated? At 10, I tracked deer with my aunt and waited by a tree in falling snow, shooting my last bullet into the air just to let her know where I was before it got too dark to search for me. At the U, I took classes, studied philosophy, European history and social linguistics, chemical tables, world religions, and still managed to remember my name and the names of my relatives and places. I've lived and traveled with no destination to speak of. I even stopped myself in the middle of dreams just to wake up, so I would remember faces, conversations, the speakers, and the voices, the mists and animals, the roads and enclosures, the running, the flying, the fear dreaming of immobility brings. Still, as I make my way back to you, stand before your door, I know that inside there is no one, as your leaving remains the hand on another door of my arrival. This is from a... I'm going to teach you all at this point. I'm told that since I work here, I'm supposed to teach once in a while. I'm going to teach you, I mean, if I can find it, maybe I won't teach you. I was going to teach you how to write an American Indian poem, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to find that poem, so maybe I won't. Instead, what I want to do is read another section. I hope you have patience with me. I have a lot of prose tonight I want to read. And, here's the American Indian Lit poem. This is going to seem kind of abstract, but I hope you can stay with me on this. This is another theorem for crafting American Indian Lit in four parts with emphasis on naming. It starts with this epilogue or a prologue or epigraph that's what remains from fire is not spirit. First of all, this will not work with olive oil or sunflower oil. A Beijing for the money. Take something Indian and take something non-Indian. Make the Indian indigenous or native or skin. Make the non-Indian non-indigenous indigenous or non-native or non-skin or white. A two for the junior. Make the Indian non-Indian and the non-Indian Indian or the white Indian. A three. Make a character out of paper. Write a name with fire or sky or a combination of color and the names of birds, or the absence of an article plus a present tense verb from a limited number of infinitives. You may include a preposition, except forego, between, beyond, under, over, into, across, beneath, beside. Avoid abstractions, slang, economic terms, hip phrases, or contemporary situations or sign. You cannot use names, for example, such as foregoes hawk, under crow, into deer, values dog, love crane, dances similar, in the middle of the night, red thunder banging, or a cross wolf, eating horse, or has in trust, or many shoes. You can't use sun dude, or chicklet, or donut shop, beneath the ground, beside the head, do not cross. You can't use out of position, or big credit, or bear pimp, or stone suitcase. You can't use ice cream turtle, or calls the taxi, waits for the bus, bums a smoke, speaks the Bible. You can't use Saint Muskrat or graffiti clouds, or air flute, or telescope woman, or medicine cheese. You might be able to get away with caramel bowl, or Mrs. Layups, or nice one, but you can't use red exit, off limits, or even working man. So maybe take a break. Offer prayers to the polytheistic Indo-European spirits of syntax. Inscribe a smoke or ceremony. Add laughter to tears or fighting. To anything that sounds like history, re-inscribe Indian, non-Indian, white. Repeat imperialism, 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 imperialism. Make crossing tongues as simple as powwow for profit and dying Chevy hey-ya as complex as Aristotle remains ethical and remains are cataloged. Use newspapers, magazines, museum brochures, scatog and flint and match. Roll characters, names, words into paper, paper into rolls. Rub with bear grease and lard or last night's ground beef leavings. Say four Hail Marys, a couple of ho-hos, or a-a-ka-we-ken. Ignite all of the above. A-forza. Be careful about who you read to. They may be hearing Indian in everything non-Indian. I've gotten quite a ways into this novel I've been working on between all the other things I've been trying to do, and this is going to be one of the longest sections of it. It's the second speaker in the novel, the second storyteller in the novel is this guy, Armstrong Cutting Eye. So I'm going to read some early sections from that and then the very last section. There's a lot in between. It's about 30 or so pages, but I want to give you some representative sections of it. just to let you know how it's going with this. And so this is the second speaker. His name's Armstrong Cutting Eye, and this is the whole novel takes place in a casino where they've set up an installation artist has set up a birch bark tree and hung word leaves on the tree. And so each speaker has to come and shake the tree. And when they shake the tree, a leaf falls down, and that's the word they must begin with. And so Armstrong Cutting Eye drew the next shortest piece of red-colored yarn. He rose from his chair beside an artificial wind machine and ambled bow-legged to the story circle. He had the air of a rock and roller about him, a trace of MTV style in his clothes and gesture. He wore a honey brown sheen suit coat over a worn gray t-shirt which read, "No news all the time, grunge for breakfast." His pants were faded bag denim which hung loose all the way down to his silver designer basketball shoes. When he shook the tree the first time, no words fell. So he hugged the tree, tilted his head upward, and blew with all his breath until a leaf came spinning down. The leaf landed at the base of the platform where the judge Simon Redthunder sat. Cutting Eye picked up the leaf, frowned, and read the word grandmothers. This is his story. The day I realized how poor I was the day I saw my grandmothers fighting in the yard. Grandmother Judy Cutting Eye Salmon had just landed a weighty right hook. Excuse me a second. Into the mouth of Grandmother Alvina Standing Grand. As the blood dribbled out of the old woman's mouth, with spewed denture and spume curses, I knew I was 13, 16 skin, which is what blood always reminds me of, my own skin, degrees. 13, 16th equals 7H, ancient Cutting Eye and 3/4 of Sonomish. It had been a good fight, though a bit uneven since Grandmother Standing Grand loomed large over all people. And she had used her luminous presence to intimidate everyone until they backed off or went forward foolishly or onwardly drunken enough to call for an ass-kicking. Believe me, I know. Before I took up hoops, old Standing Grand had kicked my butt more than a few times. But the fight, which had once been like the weather, predictably rainy, had taken another turn now and was like the seasons, almost climactic. Cutting Eye Salmon instinctively remembered the drunken sluggings of her dead husband, and she was fighting back, post-consciously imitating the technique of her husband Batter and his brain-injured progeny, Dempsey and Lewis, who both lost in the semifinals of the Idaho Golden Gloves in, gee, what year was it? Grandma Judy followed with a bloody hook, with a breathtaking body shot, dropping Standing Grand to her knees. I turned away then and went inside the Cutting Eye house to get another beer. My cousin Luke sat there in the kitchen, still sobbing at the table, his picture of his father in front of him, a flat face glossed by the bulb of light above us. Luke was crying about the land, about drinking too much, and about setting fire to his father's Jimi Hendrix records. "Jesus," I said, "will you quit crying, Luke? You've been like this for months." "It's not a good day to be Indian," he said. "My father's dead. My uncle lost his job at the cherry plant." "Let's go for a drive," I said. "I got some mushrooms in the glove box. We'll suck them up and go find the people up in the hills." When we got in the front seat, I took the mushrooms out of the glove box. Luke popped a couple of beers and we sat there for a while chewing the mushrooms and washing them down with rolling rocks. "Where'd you get these shrooms?" Luke asked. "My cousin Michael. He's an ethnobotany student at the U. He's been researching ceremonial fungi and fire-starting brackets. He gave these to me last Christmas." "Where'd you get the rolling rock?" "You ever tried them before? Out of your grandmother's refrigerator." "Yeah, but I've been conserving. I eat a little every time my relatives fight. I found out it makes their cuts and bruises more colorful. But this is really bad with my grandmother, so I'm taking as much as I can." "What are they fighting about?" "Who knows," I said. "Grandkids, missing lard, habitual anger, bingo strategies. It's Saturday, let's drive." "Some Indian cars only work in reverse. Some only work in the morning, and some only work to get you lost. My uncle Buick said it was because Indian cars are tired of being beat up, owned first by white men until they abuse them almost all to death, or just after the last 5-year payment is a 10-year memory. I don't know about all that. But my uncle passed the car on to me, complete with an empty pack of Lucky Strikes between the front seat belts and a pair of Pampers with a hole blown through them on the backseat floor. He said, be careful when you drive it. The mirrors tell more than the view through the windshield. If you can, drive only with the mirror and side windows. That crack in the windshield will fool you. After an hour or so, we came down the incline on Old Smelt Road, miles from the reservation near a suburb of Big Traverse. Luke said, see that? What, I said. That, he said, pointing to the side of the road. That big car over there in the ditch. I broke from my view in the right rearview mirror and turned to the passenger side. Beyond Luke's bristle-cut head, I saw the car, its chrome lip, nudged into the dirt ditch and rain runoff, like a dog nudged into the smell of my uncle coming home from the cherry cannery. I pulled over onto the shoulder just in front of the big Electra. Luke and I got out, walked back to the car, and peered into the driver's side window. There was no one. I opened the back door and looked in. Again, no one. Luke, I said, what's this? I dragged a black box across the back seat and out the door and set it on the ground between us. It was beginning to rain hard again, and in my mind, I saw my grandmother's fighting again. I don't know, Luke said, open it up. I flipped up the brass latches and lifted the lid. Inside, surrounded by a deep red velvet interior, and the bell in horn-shaped curves and crevices of the case, sat a disassembled silver saxophone. Wow, Luke squealed. Then he lifted the instrument out piece by piece and put the sax together. He walked around to the front of the car and jumped on the hood. The red light of our old Impala glossed across the hood, and Luke, as he playfully put his lips to the mouthpiece, in blue. He mocked a musician's expression, contorting his face into a mask of pain, like ecstasy, as a low blue note sounded from the dark hollow of the sax bell. Luke held the note for a long time. Raindrops fell into the darkness of the horn and beaded on the gleaming silver of the instrument curves and lines in the spaces between the stops. As Luke rocked and bent in performance, some of the raindrops slipped off from the instrument and floated to earth in shining full orbs of deep reflected worlds, which extended in weight and gravity as each fell to the earth. I moved closer and stared into each drop as it fell. I looked deeply into each drop, and I saw stars, a bit of some lost moon, a few dark clouds, crystallizations and fractals, and I knew that each raindrop was itself a vibration, calling out and entering the earth to move its particular place on the earth with the energy and flow of its own transitory and mattered vibrations. I felt the vibrations from where I stood on the earth. I stared for a long time like that. Then I felt and heard my own tears talking to me in a swishing, muddied river of memory streaming out and down my face. I bent over and sobbed and spontaneously spoke that tearful remembrance. And this is what the narrator says. I felt spirits watching, observing me. I prayed from a small flame in a fractured indigenous heart. I prayed for the planets, the magnetic flow and biting of Elder Sun, the material world, the gaseous wraiths and shimmers, the dense matter people, the inhabitants of mists above, the beings of flight, their blue wings, their morning calls from hidden limbs, or their brief passages through sky. I honored the keepers of the vegetal villages, the makers of heal-all and pearly everlasting, the tobacco dwellers, the red willow elders, the strawberry grandmothers, the weeping sisters of squash, corn, and bean, the brothers and great uncles of syllabary shapes and oak, maple, and elm, and ash. I gave thanks for the insect transformations, for the communities of bug people. I talked of the light-struck Mameguese. I remembered the little people, the point makers, greasy man, little hairy and any. I prayed for the hunted as providers and as the wisdom behind traps and survival weapons. I saw into the center of my heart flame and watched part of it lick back into smoke. I don't know where words came from. I remembered saying the stars' names were wrong, that the wide star roads held the names of all of us and all who came before. I spoke of the dead senses of humans, of the atrophied regions of brain and vision, of lost genes and the replication of dead moments, of lust and phoniness of our manufactured desires. I was not angry, but sorrowful. I sang the song of my dead father, recalling him barely breathing in the hospital where granddaughter sang in fours, three verses about going home. I asked for forgiveness, for the anger, for the shame that leads us to worthless worthlessness. By now, these guys end up going to a suburban sweat lodge ceremony, of all things, and they climb this hill and they come to this subdivision, and these people in the subdivision are having a sweat, and they see the door open and they go in and sweat with the people in the suburbs, and they make their prayers. But I'm going to bypass all that and turn back to the end of the story so you don't have to deal with the middle. When we got back to Grandmother Standing Grand's, Luke went back to the picture on the kitchen table. He picked it up, walked over to the counter, opened a drawer, rummaged around until he drew out scissors. He cut his father's head out of the photo, got some tape from the same drawer, and he walked into the living room. I followed. Grandmother was tied up in a chair there, her head in a knot of sleep in front of the television set on the evangelical channel. A violet bruise pulsed on her cheekbone, and a shiny knot stretched skin into a tight bubble over her right eyebrow. Jack Van Impe spouted vitriol, something about prophecy, the Middle East, the Antichrist, welfare, homosexuality, and the second burning bush in the White House. I felt weary, beaten up myself, so I went to my room where Luke had gone. He had taken his father's photo head and taped it onto Jimi Hendrix's body on the poster over my bed. This somehow made things right for Luke, even in the disproportion of the merged images. I could see it in Luke's face, feel it in a lost tension about the way he carried himself. I could also feel the mushrooms wearing off. So I lay down. Luke lay down next to me. I heard him sobbing and I could feel him shivering through the sheets and the star blanket as we both lay face up staring at the ceiling. The wind blew cool through some crack in our HUD house and sang through broken fences, the poor fit of doors, the road to the BIA school, the clinic, and the Episcopal Church. Then the wind sang the names of our village, Mary, then Betty, then Bear's Tail, then Red-Headed Strangers. It sang right through us, ran away through res trees until it got so far away, turned around on some dark highway, and came back again to find us and lick our uncovered skin until we woke from the strangeness of our own lives, these minds, bodies, in spaces where we were never home, this time under the government-made roof. I think I'll take a few more poems out and read maybe one more section of prose. I think we got a little bit of time for that. I want to save that song for Arthur, though. I have to read you this part of the reason for that I decided to write this novel, which is not a really good reason, is because people kept asking me, why haven't you written another novel? That's reason number 2B. But the first one was because I just kind of wanted to write in the style of other American Indian writers. And so it was my way of seeing if I could do that, give myself a little test. And so here's another short section of that that I'll read. This is from the Repatriate, Acts of Rematriation, by a writer named Francois Halfshell. We were frozen before we were boiled. And we were boiled before we lost our last cedar oar from our last bark canoe. But we came out of the water and went back to town and got up to go fishing the next day anyway. And we fought our lurid dreams in our day school education. And we brought our relatives back when no one else knew where they were. I know. I was there when Autumn Bingishmuk jump-started a dead Nova with her tongue in a bear claw, one on positive, the other on negative. I was there when she went to recover Pembina bones at a highway construction site near Grafton. I was there when she sliced open an Air Force bomber pilot in a Bob Evans in Grand Forks for saying those savages deserved it as he bragged about dropping skin liquidated ordnance on women and children in tribal villages. I was there when she talked Duchesne into backing his truck up to the Catholic Church so she could fill confessionals with cement before Palm Sunday Mass. And I was there when she got a pit boss fired because he couldn't find a dealer who could keep her from winning at blackjack in the Milky Way Casino. Yes, my people, I know what you're thinking. I am an old man, more mindful of desire than the truth. You'll say that I was too close to Autumn and more interested in her sexually than culturally. But I only slept with her once, and the motel had a leaky faucet, and the one book in the room told us gods and legends are made more immaculate in mystery and conception, not in fornication nor the Canadian, near the Canadian border. Others will tell you Autumn is gone, and that is as good as things will get around here. They can believe what they want, but their wants are like their beliefs, vacuous church Sundays, lost weekends, the jealous hangovers of Friday night fiddle music, and the slurred resonance of karaoke skins with one too many screwdrivers sloshing over their florid beaded belt buckles. Some will even say that Autumn was and never will be, never was and never will be. None have said it to my face, and I suspect none will as long as I'm alive, and as long as the name Menogijish still lives on this reserve. And they can be sure this name will live as long as the Red Branch drum sings the Good Day Traveling Song to the boys going off to war, and as long as they continue to eat the fry bread the Menogijish grandmothers invented when the BIA agents gave us flour for the stories we could tell over a hot cup of coffee in the cannibal winters of the Dawes Act displacements. But that's another story, and this is about Autumn Bengishmuk. And every story about Autumn is about who we really are, whether we believe it or die of that great white man's disease and perhaps his most powerful teaching, denial. I originally wrote this next poem for my sisters, but I want to read it in memory of Arthur, and just end with a short prose piece about a new life. But this is just called simply a song for sisters who won't let go. When Zakwa died, you could not say Bamapi. You could not even raise your eyes to greet even the most distant of relatives or the closest of visitors. You left silence between yourself and the northern oriole singing over sections of orange on the rail beneath the thermometer face. You turned instead from memory to memory to find memory always behind or awaiting another present of some sensual association like a luminous guide, hollowing a place for us out of this good earth. We have gone through three cycles already, singing in the round hole Lewis and Braids made once just after Gijish turned at the winter solstice to bring us longer days. Once in the moon of two dogs calling Grandpa with a request for prayers for his son in the service. Once in the month the Canadian Baha'is came to sweat with us. Now Gijish descends to disappearance in the west. The firekeeper and another Ashkabewis have already struck the fire. Boys have moved chairs into the singing lodge. Old Max has strung rope across the western side of the lodge interior between two lodge poles. Offering cloths hang over the rope there. Sky blue, violet, yellows, reds, blacks, and green and white. Two buffalo skulls rest beneath the cloth on the altar blanket with an array of pipes, men and women's, lined up before the skulls, skull faces looking east. Smudge shells, quill pokers, bone tampers, sage, sweetgrass, bags of tobacco, and a few eagle feathers set there as well. The drum sits in its place on a blanket, a circle of chairs around it. A leather bag of drumsticks leans against one of the chairs. Dancers and supporters come in and settle in place around the lodge. Women against the north side, men at the south side. The firekeeper sits at the eastern door with an iron smudge pot, a stack of wood split behind him. He smudges everyone who enters with burning cedar, snapping wisps and whirls of smoke over a bed of coals from the fire. The pipe man fills Eagle Heart's pipe, the one with the sculpted buffalo bull. The old man takes the pipe, prays in Anishinaabe Moin. After the pipe goes around, Eagle Heart clears his throat, shakes the hide rattle, He sings the Thirsty Dance Cycle, the Introduction Song, the Four Directions Song, the Buffalo Spirit Song, the Men of Eagle Set Song, his Father's Son Thunder Song, the Song of Everlasting Life, another Sun Thunder Song, the Moon Song, the Song for the End of the World. Some dancers stand and blow their whistles. Some women sing along where they ring their side of the lodges. Eagle Heart finishes, shakes the rattle three times quickly and sets it on the drum face in front of the next singer to his left. The pipe man brings another pipe. He hands it to the next singer first. Again, we smoke together around the drum. When the pipe is done, the singers start up. It goes on like this until the pipe goes around the drum four times. We finish near dawn. One of the leaders brings four cigarettes to the scout leader. He gives one cigarette to each of three men of his choosing. Women come in with plates of food, fruit, tea, coffee, juice, bologna and cheese sandwiches, macaroni dishes, water. Everyone eats. For the fasters, the dancers, this will be the last meal, the last drink until the dance is over. When we have all eaten, the scouts go out. When they return, they will bring willow to us, giving us new life. I think that's it for tonight.